This episode is brought to you by Summer School Electronics. With pedals like the Snow Day Delay, the Pep Rally Fuzz, the Trash Panda, and my personal favorite, the Science Fair, which is two classic dirt pedals in one with a mid-boosted overdrive on one side, a black lab rat circuit on the other, and a blend knob to blend between them to find the perfect classic stacked dirt sound you're looking for, it's hard not to find something you'll love. Mark builds all of his pedals by hand in Syracuse, New York, where he also works as a full-time educator. In addition to the super fun graphics on their pedals, Mark also offers custom artwork. Want your dog's face on a pedal? He can do it. Want your face on a pedal? He can make that happen too. Go over to summerschoolelectronics.com and make sure to tell them that 40 Watt Podcast sent you. Right. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this episode of the 40 Watt Podcast. Thank you for coming and listening and hanging out with us for a little while. I really appreciate it. As you heard at the top, I haven't mentioned it in a while. Y'all remember to go check out True Fire, get yourself some lessons. Christmas holidays coming. You can actually gift them to other people. I've been doing the lessons myself. I really, really like the Matt Schofield lessons that I keep going through and going back through, trying to figure out how to be Matt Schofield. I haven't figured that part out yet. But you should probably go check them out. They've got a ton of lessons and a ton of styles. You're really going to appreciate it. And if you're a first-time True Fire subscriber, my code, which is in the links below, will get you 40% off your first order. That is 40Watt, 40WATT. I appreciate the support. A little cut of that comes back to me to keep the show going, and it is much appreciated. Additionally, you heard also Patreon supporters. I really appreciate all of you. I missed reading all your names in the last episode at the end, and I'm really sorry. I'm going to make it up to you at the end of this episode. I'll read it twice. No, I'm kidding. I'll just read it one time. But thank you all for your support. If you'd like to support the podcast, please go over to patreon.com/40wattpodcast. That's 40WattPodcast. And you can help keep this show going. I sure appreciate it. All right. So this week, I'm super excited. So have Australian guitarist Adam Miller on the show. Adam, how are you, sir?
I am really good. Yeah, I'm great. Yeah.
Well, that's good to hear. See, folks are going to love this episode because Australian accents do well on this show.
Totally.
But but on top of that, so I got the opportunity to see you play in Chicago not too long ago. It was you and a band called Holly. Well, you weren't in the band. It was you, Holly, and Ariel Posen on a ticket together. And it was super cool. I was not familiar with the guitar playing before that show and have been listening now. It was interesting. I didn't expect an instrumental guitarist on that bill. You know, you expect Ariel Posen. I sort of think of him, he's a guitar player, but he's a singer-songwriter is the way I really think of him, you know? And so it was, you have this really, really fresh, really cool playing style, and you get these really cool tones. And we're going to talk about that a whole lot in this episode. But that put you on my radar, and I definitely wanted to get you on the show and talk about your guitar playing, your path, your music, and how you got into doing this. So let's start by giving that whole big picture. Who are you? How'd you get into music? How'd you get into guitar playing? That kind of thing.
Yeah, wow, that's a huge start. I'll start with the funny anecdote from that bill, actually. So Ariel and I have been friends for a while, and I also have quite a few friends in Chicago as well. So it was sort of fun to do that show together. We did a couple of shows on that tour. But funnily enough, I perform a lot with my wife, whose name is Holly. And when the poster came out, it said Holly and Adam Miller on the poster. And so many of my friends were like, oh, awesome. Holly's coming and is going to be at that gig. And it was just this funny thing that it was a Chicago based band named Holly with, is it an extra Y? I think
it is. Yeah. Extra Y.
Yeah, and it's funny because one of our friends then bought my wife one of their merch hats, and she now wears it around, which is awesome.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Anyway, that's a little funny side note from there. So big picture, I guess, yeah, I've just been playing guitar forever. I started on organ first when I was 4 years old. Picked up guitar when I was maybe 8 years old.
Okay.
And, yeah, and it was sort of, what was this, like late, very late 80s, early 90s. And I was like jamming along to things like Billy Joel's Stormfront album that had We Didn't Start the Fire on it. And
yeah.
And a couple of awesome Australian bands, one called 1927, that even looking back now, they had really awesome guitar parts and solos. But when I tried to sing along, I was like, you know, 9, 10 years old. I sucked because my voice hadn't broken. So, and then it was at a similar time where this, I guess, sort of younger Australian guitar player was coming up at the time and working his way into mainstream music in Australia by the name of Tommy Emmanuel.
Oh, yeah.
And so my mum bought me a cassette tape of a Tommy Emmanuel album, and I was like, oh, I sound exactly the same as that because we both play guitar. And that sort of set me down the instrumental path from then. And I think because I started it so young, I was sort of stuck with it. But and especially Tommy Emmanuel's albums in those days weren't acoustic. They were predominantly electric with a band as well.
Yeah, and I think here we really think of him as an acoustic guitar player because that's how
exactly
I discovered him. That's how a ton of people discovered him.
Yeah, and if you go back, there's some pretty happening electric guitar stuff. And he's, because he was sort of the number one session guy in Australia as well, like his albums cover a lot of ground from like, you know, it's probably how I learned to play so many sort of different styles, like the sort of Stevie Ray side of things. And then the, you know, the more shreddy fusion sort of things. And, you know, he used to have a lot of guests on his albums as well. So that was like my first exposure to Larry Carlton and Robin Ford was because they did guest appearances on his albums, which are probably hard to find now with streaming because they're not credited, but you know,
right.
If you ask, I can tell you which tracks they're on.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go back and actually, now that I've not done the deep dive into Tommy Emmanuel, to be honest,
yeah,
but I've listened to a lot of the acoustic stuff without even yeah realizing he'd done a ton of electric stuff. So now I have yeah to go back and listen to that.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, it started my love with essentially the Telecaster as well, because Tommy always, you know, his guitar that's iconic to him in my eyes is not a Maton acoustic, but it's this 60, I think it's a 68 Telecaster Custom Sunburst bound. He had three pickups in it that I think were Bartolini's, and it's got like, oh, wow, no finish on it, sort of like, you know, it's a cool guitar. So yeah, so that
I've
that was sort of
that out.
Yeah, where I went through the 90s, and then towards the end of the 90s I started touring with Tommy. But in the acoustic guitar side of things, he was just gotcha starting to do that in Australia. So I was opening up shows for him, playing solo acoustic guitar. And I can guide it through and keep sort of going. It's it's sort of a long story, and a lot of it has to do, I guess, with like musical culture, which I'm a big have a big interest in, of like where you grow up and how that affects how you play. So,
oh, that's it's such a massive thing. And on this podcast, we talk about it a whole bunch because
yeah
I'm from the Mississippi Delta. And so I'm from cool Clarksdale, Mississippi. And most of my playing has been in blues and soul and jazz bands. And so that's the way I play. It influences everything I do.
Yeah,
Even when I'm trying to play, like I've sat in and played with country bands. Well, guess what? You're going to get a healthy dose of blues and soul in this country ensemble. So, it's really, really tied in. I do want to come back, though. So you said you started organ at 4?
Yeah, not well. It was just,
sure,
I think my mum had friends that sent their kids off to organ lessons, and it was the same. And it was the Yamaha method, which I've never really heard anyone else talk about. But the Yamaha method is very much ear training. So it was like, it was all ear, and it was very little reading, which is strange for a keyboard instrument. So it really set me up well for just going, you know, as soon as I picked up a guitar, even one of the really strange things I did was I didn't actually like learn a chord, and it was, you know, pre-internet and being able to find things. I basically just worked out where the keyboard was up each string. So I just saw black and white notes, and I still do. Like, that's how I see a guitar. Like, I go,
that's so wild.
There's, I see the keyboard up each string. And so before I could play like a normal C chord, I worked out how to play a C triad the way you would on a piano, because yeah, I was like, exactly. Oh yeah, that's a C, that's an E, that's a G. Cool. That's how I do it. And, you know, and I sort of learned a few things backwards in that way. And instantly, like, I could see, I could tell you where every note was on the fretboard. I could just that's an A.
That's so important.
Yeah. Which, you know, in teaching later in life, and I spent 10 years teaching at a university as well. I realized that wasn't a normal thing. It was so natural to me to just go, oh, that's where the notes are. Why don't you know?
Well, I was going to say, as a guitarist who later went to college for music and had to take 2 years of piano, the twist my brain had to make to get it, you know, the keys. And I've always said, and it's funny that you started organ so early. I've always said that if I had it all to do over again, if I could start over, like back up the years and pick like what instrument are you going to focus on, it would have been Hammond organ for me. That's what I would have focused
Look,
on.
Look, it instead. Wasn't a Hammond organ that I started on.
No.
Like, it was the one that has the like five different drum beats and they're all bossa nova. And if you're super hip, you can push like a couple of buttons in at a time. And, you know, now that would create indie rock hits, but at the time,
yeah, it would.
That's so cool. Yeah.
Not so cool then. Yeah, in the 90s, they weren't as into that.
No, definitely not.
Oh, there's a... Yeah. I just had another old song from the musician, comedian Tim Minchin pop into my head, and he has a song called Rock and Roll Nerd, where it's essentially him talking about himself, and there's a whole line where... how he wanted to be a big rock star, but he learned piano instead of guitar, which in the 90s didn't get you very far. So yeah, it's real good. But anyway,
yeah, that's cool. Yeah, yeah. I have friends that play in his band actually.
Oh really? Yeah, he's phenomenal. He is an absolute master wordsmith, and a killer piano player too. So you got into teaching as well. So that's something I thought I was going to end up doing as a profession before I took a deviation. I thought I was going to go to school for musicology and ethnomusicology and very much study that line of thinking of, you know, how music that where you're from affects and how it affects. I wanted to study the effect of jazz and blues on American culture and history.
Yeah, cool.
Which is really cool. So, but now, is music your full-time gig?
Yeah. It always sort of has been. And even like when I was teaching the university, it was, you know, I wasn't a full-time professor. It was not even quite 6 months of the year, really, it works out. So it was sort of between touring and, doing, everything else, but it was really fun. And I actually didn't study music. I did actually for 6 months at university, but it was classical guitar, and it was mainly to get into another degree at the time.
Yeah.
So I did never graduate anything, but I got offered my job on professional reputation, you know, years later. And so
it
was amazing, and it was really fun to go down that road and you know, learn probably more myself than students ever did.
I ultimately couldn't get a full music degree at the university I was at because they didn't have a real path for a guitarist. They had a music education path, and they had other paths, but they were all very, you know, the instrument choices were basically some type of brass or woodwind, percussion, piano, or voice. They didn't really have a path for a guitarist. So I ended up with a interdisciplinary degree where I studied music and audio engineering, and that was my degree path.
Cool.
So
it was great.
Again, a very non-traditional way to get into music or music program. So you do that. So you've been recording. Oh, I'm going to give some information just based on your Spotify. So there's some stuff before this. The earliest album on your Spotify is from 01. Is that your first album?
We'll be right back.
This podcast is supported in part by String Joy Strings. I'm a snob, at least that's what people tell me. I'm never okay with good enough, and that's where String Joy Strings come in. They're better than good enough. They're the best. String Joy are making some of the finest strings available today right up the road from me in Nashville, Tennessee. They offer custom sets, balanced tension, coated strings, the works. If you need it, they can probably make it happen. You should be using String Joy Strings, and if you're going to order from them, you really could help this podcast out by clicking the affiliate link down in the description or show notes below. You get amazing strings, I get a little bit of that back to help the show keep going. It's a win-win situation. Get your String Joy Strings today.
Technically, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
So I'll go into it like a little bit, and it's kind of, if we go through the albums, there's a little bit of a story of like how things work out and how like growing up in Australia is a little bit different to growing up in the US and how music works. But that first album sort of, it never really came out then. I think I burnt, 50 copies on a CD.
Gotcha.
It was around the time I'd first started touring with Tommy Emmanuel and doing some shows. It was actually a university assignment for sound engineering.
Oh, nice.
So, I got to borrow some vintage U87s and a Tascam DA88 recorder for anyone that's super in the vintage know that used to run on Hi8 video cassette tapes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so that was the way you could multitrack in those days.
Yep.
Before I know computers
someone who
recorded
a whole lot on those.
Yeah, so they were pretty cool, and that was what came out. But I actually couldn't play many shows then because there was just no outlet for me. Like there was no way to play a solo instrumental guitar show in my town or many other towns in Australia. Like Tommy Emmanuel did it, and at that stage he was doing like big concert halls in Australia, and those shows I did with him were amazing, but outside of that I couldn't really do anything. And where I'm from and live again now, a city called Newcastle, which is, it's 2 hours drive north of Sydney, which is still, for those, that's still 10 hours drive south of Brisbane and 24 hours drive south of Cairns for those people that are for a bit of Australian geography.
This is your weekly reminder that Australia is a giant country.
Yeah. Physically bigger than the continental US is the reminder. Yes. Newcastle is very much a rock town, rock music. And at the time it was very much like in the early 2000s, just you played in rock bands or the only other gigs going around were the ones where you had like the MIDI file backing tracks.
Oh, and
you had
gosh.
To sound like a
band,
real band
in a box.
Yeah. All that. Yeah. That was the whole thing. There was like one jazz gig going around the city, and I wasn't allowed to get it cause I was too young. And it was just, I had this music and I got to play it very rarely. And so that album didn't really exist outside a couple of random little gigs because there was just no way to actually play. There was no outlet and there was no way to do it at the time.
Yeah. Did you ever at some point think about just going, okay, I either need to learn to sing or I need to find a singer, otherwise I'm not going to get to gig?
Aside from that, I was playing in multiple rock bands. I was in a band that was like the Chili Peppers. And, I've lived a million other lives, so it wasn't like that was my only way to play, but the music I was writing that was in that stage, it was the only thing I could sort of do. So, yeah.
Yeah.
And so that album is very Tommy Emmanuel acoustic style. It's like full. I recorded the whole thing in an hour, actually.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's wild. That's a pretty wild experience. Most people would, I'm not sure if a studio would love or hate you because their hourly rate wouldn't be very high for your studio time. According
yeah,
to that kind of
I wish I don't really pull that off ever since, but then I just think I was just playing so much and the songs were just right in my wheelhouse at the time. So I got through it really quick. Yeah.
Oh, so from then to now, how's the scene for a solo guitarist?
Well, yeah, so it just sort of evolved over time. It was like sort of working out ways to play. And I, as a solo guitar, solo guitar was never really my true love. Like, it was always instrumental music and groove and funk and that sort of stuff. And eventually, it was a few years later, me and some really good friends started this instrumental band, and it had, you know, it was drums, bass, guitar, saxophone. And we eventually talked ourselves into getting a residency. I think we did like this songwriter's night where you got, you know, like a 20-minute set, and we blew the place up. It was awesome. And then the venue said, well, we'll let you do like a Wednesday night, and it's three sets, but you can do one set of your weird instrumental stuff, but the other two sets are got to be like pop covers.
Yeah.
And we're like, oh, okay, cool. And the first night we did it, the first set went off so much that we had really no choice but then to do the next two sets of the same instrumental stuff. And then it sort of blew up a little bit from there. And it allowed us at least to just be able to go and start to play whatever we wanted in those scenarios, because we just developed the credibility. And, you know, that was, how early was that? Maybe like 2002, 2003, I think we started to do that. And then the city sort of evolved. And I think it was a lot of things like internet access and exposure to music, and that just allowed things to expand sort of more out and have more diversity in the music that was played around town and what you could actually do. Yeah.
Yeah, and I feel like from there to now, I live in a I won't call it a complete musical desert, because it's not, but in some of the more populated areas, like your Chicago's, your Nashville's, your New Orleans, those being my favorite cities. I just spent a week in Atlanta. In those kinds of cities, there's a place now for, you know, that kind of non-mainstream music. Because it really is. I've got some friends in our tiny little college town of Cleveland, Mississippi, that started an instrumental band, and it took them a little while to get some meaningful gigs, but then once they started to just play a little bit, people sort of got hip to it. Yeah. And yeah, you know, they're not the band that's going to play, you know, the cover bar where everybody's just there to have a band to dance and drink to, but there's definitely more opportunities for them now than when they started. And I find that really fascinating to see that as we're reaching a stage that music is so accessible, musics that maybe would not have been able to stand in those pre-internet days, they're finding an audience now. They're finding those people who are really into it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just the general exposure of all of it as well, which is kind of cool. So I know for me, it's just sort of been this gradual thing of being able to sort of do that. And then, you know, I've been touring around the world for, I don't know, 15, 16 years now as well. And it's sort of that whole, as it sort of gradually goes, but I still notice so much how playing in those environments here at home just impact the way I write music and how I construct things. Like it has this really strange specific thing that's because of where I grew up and where I live, which I, you know, sometimes really appreciate and really despise.
As someone who, again, can't get the blues out of their playing, sometimes I just really wish I could play like someone else.
Yeah.
And not the normal play like someone else, not the, oh, I really wish I could do what Steve Vai does, or, oh, I really wish I could do what Johnny Hyland does, or, oh, I really wish, you know, XYZ player, whether that be anyone from Derek Trucks and Joey Landreth to even John Mayer. It's like, you are who you are, and you're a product of that place that you're from.
Yeah.
Especially you're from the place, you musically, you are from the place that you spent the most time musically interacting with the other musicians of that area. Mm. And I think that matters more than the geography of the place. It has to do with those musicians.
I would almost disagree with that a little bit as well sometimes. Yeah, yeah, because sometimes you get so influenced by the things that are around you. I don't know. Yeah, yeah, maybe.
Yeah, it's a fun thought experiment to think along those lines. And what really did influence you? What, you know, because I, for example, grew up, I was just having this discussion with someone else last week. I grew up without guitar heroes. I took up guitar and didn't have guitar heroes. Yeah. I listened to singer-songwriters. I listened to vocalists. I listened to, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, the guitar was there, and that was to me, it was a vehicle for the song.
Yeah,
and so it was a long time before I really got into any of the players that people consider guitar heroes. And even now, I have a limited attention span for some of the mealy. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I was opposite, I think, just because when I was growing up, especially 90s and the grunge era of things, I just thought it sounded like a lot of people that couldn't play very well. And and once again, being like in a, you know, sort of, I didn't have access to music that was like, you know, jazz and blues records that were coming out then, because they weren't in record stores, and I didn't have older friends doing it, and you know, CDs.
You didn't have
Australia
a radio station playing them.
Well, it was definitely not a radio station. And you know, like CDs were $40 in Australia back then, and so you know, that was a serious investment. You bought a CD, and if you didn't like it, you played it till you did like it. That was how it was, and so. And, you know, some of my favorite music is still that way. John Scofield is how I got into him. You know, like I bought a John Scofield album and I really didn't like it at all. I was like, this guy cannot play guitar. He's just like, and then, you know, because that was my immediate feeling. I'm going to be brutally honest about that. And, you know, I probably sound a lot like Scofield now, so that's fine. And then it was like, after listening to it maybe for a month, I was like, no, this guy is unbelievable. Like, this is all the stuff that's amazing. But I swear, if I'd listened to Scofield in streaming days, then I probably
never would have gone back to it.
Yeah,
yeah, you would have never got through it, never gone back to it. I get that. Actually, it's similar.
Sorry,
to
John Scofield, just because I know you were talking about Matt Scofield.
Yeah, Matt Scofield's different. I don't think there's a relation there. I don't think
Actually, I have two shows with Matt this week in Australia, so that
do you
be
really
fun. Yeah
Well, tell Matt he's welcome on the podcast anytime that he wants to
I'll
come
let him know
embarrass me with his guitar knowledge. So but I felt, you know, I had a similar experience where I was taking guitar lessons and I was getting into jazz, and even this is so painful, even today I sort of don't like the guitar as a lead jazz instrument. I mean, it's good, and it works, and it's my instrument, and it's what I play when I play jazz. I'll always be a blues player who plays jazz and never a jazz guitarist. But I was trying to find other guitar players to listen to, and I didn't know. You know, I'm 19 years old. Asked my guitar instructor, hey, you know, who should I listen to? And he was like, actually, I had a really thick Southern accent. I was like, hey, man, you need to listen. You need to listen to Pat Metheny.
Yeah.
And so I went out and bought the first Pat Metheny record I could find. Unfortunately, it was possibly the worst Pat Metheny record of all time, an album called Zero Tolerance for Silence. If you're familiar with that one at all, it sounds like two out of tune guitars recorded on a Tascam 4-track. That's what it sounds like. And I was like, this is awful.
Yeah.
That I can't listen to this. And to this day, I sort of still hold that opinion, even though I love Pat Metheny now, and I've gotten into his playing. And it was an album that supposedly was a big middle finger to his record label, but I'll digress there. The same experience with listening to John Scofield that you had, I went through an experiment where I was picking albums that were sort of genre defining albums, and I wanted to listen to them. Like, this was the album that kicked off, you know, bebop, or this was the album that's credited with whatever. And I got to fusion. And so I listened to Bitches Brew by Miles Davis. And at first listen, I was like, this is a train wreck. Like, it sounded like a literal train wreck recorded.
Yeah.
But I was like, no, there's something here. Like, obviously there's something here if it inspired an entire genre. So yeah. I listened to that album for 2 weeks. Nothing but that album. I didn't listen to anything else. And by the end of it, I started to understand. Like, I got it. Like, yeah. there's a theme running through this entire track, this entire song. And sometimes the drummers got it. And sometimes, I think that's McLaughlin on that album. And sometimes McLaughlin's got it. Sometimes Miles Davis has it. And that's what's holding the whole thing together while everybody else is experimenting. So instead of, you know, a band holding the thing together while a soloist experiments and travels, it was the opposite. And it was when my brain comprehended it, it was like, oh, that's so cool. But I had to make myself do it.
Yeah. 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 It's a fun thing to go down those rabbit holes of artists. And I still try to listen to things definitely in albums and multiple times. So I'm not just skipping past things going, oh yeah, cool. Next.
Oh yeah. I'm not a singles listener. I'm real bad at it. I like to listen to albums. I like to listen to like whole, I think of them as whole thoughts or whole pieces as an album. That might have come from my days as a music major, going to a lot of symphonic shows or piano pieces where you hear things in movements. And I think of albums as movements of a greater work.
Yeah.
And I think we really saw that in the 70s and the early 70s and late 60s of some of the albums. Like the first four Zeppelin albums are very much that to me. So getting to your music, I've spent the last few days listening to a lot of it.
Yeah, nice. Thank you.
I don't know a single track name. I'm going to tell you that right now.
Not a problem. It's always the hardest thing with instrumental music.
It's not only that, but it's like I don't have liner notes anymore. Like, you'd buy a CD and you'd listen to it front to back, and so you'd be reading the liner notes, or at least I did.
Yeah.
And so I'd learn track names. Don't have that anymore. And so half the time I've got headphones on doing other things while I'm listening to music.
Totally.
But cool. Something that a vibe I got from your music is that it really, like, your songs come across to me like guitar paintings. Like there's where you hear instrumental guitar. Like, oh, this is an instrumental guitar album. People's brains tend to go to something, at least mine does, go to things like Steve Vai, Satriani, you know, the really highly technical, proficient speed players that's what they do.
Yeah.
I didn't get any of that with yours. Yours comes across as like, I don't know, it's a painting as opposed to like this, I don't know, aerobic workout.
Yeah.
And I really like that. So how's your approach to creating these songs and recording them?
Definitely like the last few. So for a long time, it was all, I was like a solo acoustic guitar player. And a lot of it was about how much can I play at once? And, you know, and definitely came from the Tommy Emmanuel school of things. But then I discovered Charlie Hunter sort of not long after that. And so Charlie was probably one of the biggest influences on me ever. And I just love the fact that, well, one, he was playing like groove, funk and jazz music and improvising, but still playing fingerstyle guitar, which I didn't think was possible.
Right.
And I did come to him late, like maybe 2001, 2002, maybe later. And it was actually through John Mayer I discovered him. So it was like, when John Mayer was playing a fan fret guitar for Neon, a Novax, and it was actually the first John Mayer signature guitar for those that, you know, want to get super. Before he had a Martin, before he had a Fender, before he had a PRS, he had a Novax.
Yeah, it's actually on the cover of Room for Squares.
Well,
it's behind him.
That's
on
his
the
original
cover.
One. That's not the signature one.
Oh, is that not the signature one? Okay.
No, the signature one was a different model, and you've kind of got to deep dive the internet to search for it. But anyway,
I did not. I knew that he played that, and so I assumed that was the one that was the in, the signature one, but I didn't realize
he had multiple. No, he plays the signature one on the Any Given Thursday DVD.
Gotcha.
And it's like a purple heart topped thing, and it's sort of like offset. I don't know, like L5 sort of shape. It's a big guitar. It's cool.
Okay.
I really, dug it. But in the audio commentary of that song, he talks about ripping off this song, Neon, from Charlie Hunter, and how much of a huge Charlie Hunter fan he was. And so I was like, oh, I better find this guy.
Yeah.
And that blew up everything for me. And what I loved about his playing was that there was all this stuff going on, but there was this simplicity to it from the listening end. It was like, you don't know all this stuff is going on unless you sort of really listen. It's not like this obvious, here's 1,000 notes in a bar. It's like, there's all these things, and it's complicated enough to keep me interested, but the result is that it just creates this great groovy, funky music for the audience to listen to. And so I kind of went down that path, but doing it on 6-string guitar for the most part. I did.
Right.
And I do own currently one of Charlie's old guitars.
Oh, that's rad.
Yeah. And so I do play that a fair bit, but mainly for singer songwriters and things, not as my own music. But it just sort of led me down this path of creating music that was sort of more melodic and had these groovy bassline things to it. And once I had all the techniques down, it allowed me to just write songs really quickly because I could do it all at once. If I heard a bassline, I can play it. If I hear the melody, I can play it along. And that sort of, I guess, was a lot of the focal point for, actually, it's pretty much how I write most of my music still. So it sort of comes in a complete form on a guitar straight away, which is, you know, pretty amazing.
That's incredible. I'm incredibly jealous right now.
Yeah. So it's just this way of being able to, you know, sort of, and I guess also because I am generally thinking in two parts or three parts at a time, then it means that all those individual parts are a little bit simpler than writing some sort of crazy. So thinking in two or three parts at a time.
Yeah.
And it just means the result of like sort of what I'm composing is generally simpler than the idea of like shredding like, you know, a crazy bebop headline or something. It's not how I think. Yeah. Sometimes I will write like that, but it's rare. So the music sort of becomes this, you know, almost like pop music, I guess. And that's maybe even more how I compose, in that the songs that I'm writing, I rather than like A, B or head, a lot of the time I'm still hearing verse, chorus, bridge. Just from that sort of vibe, which is, I guess, sort of a different way to write instrumental music. And a lot of it, came from playing like local shows in Newcastle more than anything, where I'd just take this stuff out to see how it went. And my audiences are not jazzer and they're not instrumental audiences. They're just people to come and hear music. So it's very varied, and gave me a very good idea of sort of what went down.
Yeah.
And then the last like three albums or so as well, which is sometimes strange when people have seen me play solo, is that they're not solo.
Right. No,
they're predominantly with a trio, if not more, and often multiple guitar parts, because to be perfectly honest, that's just what I like to hear. In a recording, I'm, solo guitar works and I can do it, but, I don't really want to listen to it, if that makes sense. So I like making albums with drums and bass. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that sounds great. I love that you mentioned the Charlie Hunter connection, because that made me feel a little validated, because after I heard you play, after listening to some of the songs, and I told my wife, and I also described it to someone else when we, you know, locked in this date to record this episode. I was telling them, you're going to enjoy the next episode. You know, this is who I'm with. And I said, they're instrumental guitarists. And I said, think like Charlie Hunter. And it's because that was the vibe I got. So I'm glad to know that I was My ears were there. Totally
on the ball, man. Like, when I discovered him, it was like, oh, wow, not only is he, like, doing all this stuff in a fingerstyle way, but it was also, he's also writing and playing music that I like as well. So everything sort of does sound, you know, it has a pretty similar vibe. And he's just the best dude. He's been such a huge influence on me as a, you know, musician and a person that it's awesome. Yeah.
I've always heard he's a pretty good dude. I've never had the honor of meeting him, but he definitely was one of those players that the first time I encountered him, it was one of those that the way he played was so different than what I was used to it took a minute to just wrap my brain around what was going on. And then I think I saw a rig breakdown from him once and how he runs, you know, the two, I can't remember now. It's like the two or three lowest strings into a bass amp.
Three bass strings. Yeah. And
is it five high strings or four?
Well, back in the day it was five, then it went to four, and now it's three. Actually.
Oh, wow. But, okay.
Yeah. We won't do a Charlie Hunter rig rundown today.
Yeah. It's a ridiculous thing that's going on, and I love it. Mm. Speaking of gear, this is a good segue. We're a guitar podcast around here.
Sure.
Mostly guitar players listening to it. What are you playing? What do you play predominantly?
So guitar-wise, electric guitar-wise, there's sort of two main ones that I've been playing for the last several years. The main one is a Nick Huber from Germany, which was the guitar you would have seen me play at that show. And it's based on his Rietbergen model. And essentially, it's a giant 335 size Tele. Is the easiest way to explain it.
Yes.
I've got it behind me. If I grab it, then I do all these things that don't translate for audio. So I'll explain it.
Yeah.
Yeah. The size of a 335, but Nick's body shape is sort of more like a Telecaster, you know, sort of influence. The scale length is 25 and a half inch. My guitar is mahogany back and sides. It's sort of one piece routed out like a, so it's got a block through the center, but it's just one piece of wood for the entire back and sides.
Yeah.
A mahogany neck.
I love when people do that.
Yeah. And then the top is carved redwood. And so it's carved inside it out as well. And it's, So
Are you familiar with Gres guitars?
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, yep. So I've got a Gres Mendocino baritone. That's the same thing. The back and sides are one carved piece of wood, and the top is redwood. Of course, mine's a baritone.
It's actually a very similar thing. And then it has two gold foil pickups in it, Lola gold foils. Oh,
that's so rad.
Yeah, so I got this guitar about, I think it was 6 or 7 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And it sort of just instantly became part of my whole thing and sound. And, you know, it then developed that people just started ordering it. So it's turned into the Adam Miller signature model, which is really cool. Like, it wasn't sort of the intention, but that's it. You can actually get them now. But it's, and it's super light because of those woods. I'll hold it up for the video people.
Yeah, for video folks. Yeah. So I'll tell you what it reminds me of a little bit, just like at glance. And, you know, I'm not going to get way down the rabbit hole of comparisons, but are you familiar with the Godin Montreal?
Similar, yeah, yep, yeah.
It has a little bit of that, because that's a buddy of mine swears by, he's bought at least two of those Godin Montreals, and I think he was hunting for a third one since they discontinued it.
Yeah,
and
then
they put out a new version. He's like, he doesn't like that one. He likes the old version.
No, the old one. Yeah, there was mahogany top and that sort of thing. Yeah. Yeah, I know the one. So, yeah, and it was just, I'd been a good friend of Nick for a long time, and we talked about getting a guitar, and it was just, this one always sat really well when I was sitting and playing, because it's sort of, it's got this awkwardly big, why can't I think of it? The waist.
Yeah.
Like it, you know, when I first saw this model, I thought, oh, you need to bring the waist in more. But when you actually sit with the guitar, it puts it right in your lap really well. And so, this is sort of it. It just got refretted because I destroyed the whole thing from playing it so much. But yeah, that's been sort of the main guitar for years. And essentially it was because then I've had this Tele that I played for, which I, well, still play. And I built it from parts, being a super guitar nerd.
Yeah, that's what we do at some point. Every guitar player has to do that parts build. They've got to do
it. Well, I've built multiple, and this was the first one that was good. Like, you know, going back to the Charlie Hunter thing, like the day I heard him, I went to a, I can never say this correctly with a US accent, to a pawn shop. Bought, you know, a cheap Strat and put two bass strings on it and ripped the pole pieces out of pickup so it'd have stereo output so I could play Charlie Hunter style. And I did a gig that weekend with a drummer doing that. So that was my first one. But the Tele I play a lot of times. So it's a thin line. It's a MJT body, which is like the eBay online thing. It's really cool. I managed at the time to get a solid one-piece rosewood neck from Warmoth, which is insane. And then it's got a mastery bridge and it's got a Seymour Duncan, what are they called? An SM1 mini humbucker neck pickup, which is like incredible. And that pickup, because of various things when I was routing the guitar, and when I say routing, I mean using a drill to get the pickup in.
The right kind of DIY around.
Yeah, and then it wouldn't fit in the guitar with the tabs on it. And so you're meant to bend the tabs on those to make them smaller and re-drill them. When I bent it, they broke. So that pickup is super glued onto pieces of Indian rosewood blocks to support it up, and it's just super glued in the guitar. And, you know, I'm going to say that is the secret to the tone of that.
That's it, super
particular
glued
instrument. Yeah. And so that guitar is really special. It's in the last couple of years, I've started to actually freak out a little bit about it. You know, traveling, I'm like, oh, I used to just, you know, check it in a mono gig bag, and now I'm a little bit freaking out about it.
Yeah, a little terrified.
Getting damaged. Yeah, so trying to be more respectful of that guitar. So they're sort of the two main electric guitars that have featured on the last couple of albums.
It's always a fun thing when a parts build actually works out. I at least that's what I'm told. I've yet to have one I've put together be worth a damn.
Yeah.
So
This one, it's pretty ridiculous. And it's it's just such a cool guitar, the way it turned out. And, you know, I'm pretty sure it was a big influence on like Matt's from Mule Guitars. He's Mule Caster design. He kind of drew a lot of inspiration from that guitar because he'd seen me play it when he was still only just making the steel body resonators and things. So it's super cool. And then basically, like, amplifier wise it's Turok stuff, which I've been playing Turok stuff since 2007. And I'd been researching them since 1999. And it was, I couldn't access them in Australia for a long time. Yeah. So,
I was going to say, I've recently, in the last year and a half or so, gone to being a Turok player and absolutely obsessed with the sound of them.
Oh, nice. Just what model do you have?
I have the traditional clean.
Oh, awesome.
And it boiled down to, I was looking at a bunch of things, and ultimately somebody posted a Facebook locally, within 3 hours driving distance, one for sale at a price that I could not turn down. Mm. And I'm glad I got it when I did, because prices have not exactly gone down since then. So
no, exactly. Yeah. So, and yeah, I've only had a few of them. Mm-hmm. Over that time, but yeah, they're just such a huge part of how I play and how I record as well. Like, recording wise it's I think there's a couple of songs on my Defining of Success album where I used a 60s Champ But I think I still use the Two Rock cab when I was recording. So it's, yeah, but yeah, that's just sort of been a huge part of everything forever. And then...
So what I was going to ask, I saw, and I think I can see it behind you, but I've seen in some of your videos you use a Burnside.
Yeah, well, it is just there,
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, the Burnside's a really cool little sort of tweed thing. It's actually super light.
Really?
Because it's a pine cab versus most Turoks are usually, what's it, the marine
Baltic
grade
birch.
Ply.
Yeah, Baltic birch.
Yeah, the ply thing. So... it you know, for local gigs and getting in and out of things quickly, it's amazing. And I'm trying to think. I think I've used it on one song on the record that's coming out soon. Actually, that song is out that it's on.
Yeah, I was gonna say you've got a single released.
Yeah, the last single I released called Aging, that is the Burnside actually. But I didn't use it on the rest of the album because it's actually very loud, that amp. Despite being mine is the original 18 watt one, they're now 28 watts. Just they use a different transformer, and the originals came with 6V6s. They now come with 6L6s. But despite that, it's brutally loud.
Yeah, that doesn't
and
surprise
so,
me.
Yeah, so for most of the time, I actually record with my classic reverb signature, which strangely enough is, well, it can be loud too, but
yeah,
you know, it sounds exceptional at low volumes. And that's actually, I've used that for, most of my recording since I've had it.
That's a really interesting observation because I've discovered the same thing with the traditional clean. So it's a 100 watt amp. Yeah. I use it on 100 watt mode. I don't drop it down to 50 almost ever. And like right now I've got it set up. It's over here, running through a Captor X cause I'm getting ready to do a bunch of, video content. And that's just a better place for it. I don't have the cab in the room. But even when I've used it live, it has such a great master volume that it sounds so good at almost any volume. Yes. I love it turned up a whole lot, obviously, just like any guitar player should. I shouldn't even say good guitar player. Any guitar player should. But I've also got a divided by 13 RSA 31, which is a, you know, Vox kind of like streamlined AC 30 like thing. And that it's that whole wattage doesn't mean anything really argument. RSA 31 is a louder amp by a long shot. Yeah. It's loud.
What I realized recently, well, not that recently, several years ago, was actually that I like playing at lower volumes. I'm actually one of those guys that when I turn up the big two rock, I don't enjoy it as much as when it's actually quieter.
Really?
And that can also be the fact that I've spent so much time playing with it quieter that the amp actually likes that. You know, one of the big nerdy sort of secrets the two rock guys realized years ago was just how much amps change with certain players, and that like my amp versus someone getting an amp the same day, you know, like we're not talking component differences or anything, like, and then coming back a few years later with the same amp, that they gonna sound sometimes drastically different by the way the components age, depending on how you play it, where you play, the settings you use all the time, and, you know, all those weird little components just age in different ways. And so, I don't know if mine's just got used to being played quiet and it'll be there, but Matt Schofield's going to use that this week, so I'll be interested to hear how he thinks it sounds.
Oh, yeah, that'll be interesting.
Maybe it'll suck for him. I don't know.
Maybe. And
Matt,
of course,
Matt
when
does
I saw
play
you,
pretty loud.
When I saw you in Chicago, you actually used Matt from Mule's Hampstead.
Yeah, I did. I unfortunately didn't really get a chance to work out that amp very long. My sound check was very quick that day. And,
I bet.
And then I realized right at the end of the sound check that the amp was set to like 1 watt or something. It has a wattage. It has all these switches on the back, and I didn't realize they were there, which usually I'd be better prepared for that. But I actually, yeah, realized right at the end. I'm like, oh, that's right. And so anyway.
Yeah, I got to play that amp. He had it set up at his booth over at Fretboard Journal earlier that day. And so I got to play on that amp for a little bit. It was a killer amp. But I was using it obviously very quietly, much quieter than even your stage volume at quiet would be. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's sort of the main gear. And then I use a couple of pedals, a few things in sort of strange ways.
I'm into strange ways. So yeah, let's start there.
So like the from touring and budgets of touring, I've been like basically playing with, you know, the smallest mono pedal board for quite a few years now, just so I can, you know, fit it in a suitcase. And I kind of generally have like maybe one or two overdrive pedals. The main one I've been using, the main two I sort of use are a Vemuram Janray and another Japanese pedal. The Free the Tone SOV2. Which does like a low gain thing really insanely well. And that's possibly how I get to play quiet all the time, because I can leave one of those pedals on just barely gained and have a little bit of impact. The industry standard Strymon Flint, because they just work.
Yeah.
And
especially if you're playing an amp that doesn't have reverb or trim.
Yeah, well, it's just, and even just the consistency of reverb, especially when you're playing solo, the reverb is your, you know, that's your whole band. So you've got to get used to how it bounces around. And then the pedal that I've been using the last couple of years is the Chase Bliss Mood. And that does some really cool things. So essentially it's two pedals in one. One side is, let's just call it a digital delay.
Right.
And the other side is a looper, but not in the traditional sense at all. And I, you know, I'm a massive Frizzell fan. Bill Frizzell is like my, that's probably the music I listen to 80% of the time of Bill Frizzell albums.
Yeah. He's a killer and so player. Absolutely monster player.
Yeah. And so I was, you know, really got into the whole Line 6 DL4 thing and the looping side of stuff and that atmospheric thing. But as anyone knows, the old DL4s fail all the time. They suck.
Yeah.
And so, and also I just wasn't a fan of spending the time setting up loops, like just to go, you know, start, stop, reverse, all that sort of stuff. And I didn't use it enough to warrant it, but the Mood, basically the way I have the preset I've worked out in it is that it's constantly listening to, like, I think it's the last 3 seconds or so that I've been playing. I hit one button and it just plays that in reverse and loops it in reverse. And so I've just got this little background thing to be able to do that. And I usually have it set up with just a touch of, like, it's not quite, it's longer than a slapback delay, but I just have this delay setting. And I've sort of used this weird delay setting for years that just sort of works. It's this time, and I couldn't tell you what it is in milliseconds. I just know what it sounds like. It's dirt, dirt.
That, yeah, the Mood is such a an intimidating pedal to me. And the blooper in that same that Chase Bliss makes, and
the,
of course,
now the blooper I was looked too intense for me to sort of spend. The Mood I actually did, I went to a store and tried it out, and I could not get it to do what I wanted it to do. And I read the manual again online. I think it will do it, though. I just couldn't work out how it worked in the moment of the store, and the store was no help. So I just bought it. And then I, you know, managed to find all these great things on it. And I got it while I was while I was finishing off the last album I released called Unify. Mm-hmm. And so it sort of features quite prominently, especially on the song Shipping. And there's like multiple parts that are just the Mood playing. And I just found all these things that it could do. So in that, there's like all these like things going on in the background, and that's all the Mood. There's another song called Adam Levy. which I wrote for Adam Levy.
Right.
And it sounds like there's an organ in the background, a pad, and that's the mood going as well. But I'm literally playing the mood because you can shift the clock, the digital clock. And when you shift the digital clock, it pitch shifts in fifths the way an organ will go blah, blah, blah.
Oh, yeah.
And so I, you know, set up this pad on it and the loop, and I played it for the whole song and just played the pedal. And if you, you know, get into it, there's this organ part going in the background, but it's just the mood pedal, really.
It's so cool. And I listen to other people use it to great effects. I have the, it's actually over here behind me.
Yep.
The Microcosm by Hologram Effects or Hologram Electronics. Cool. Mm. And, I've got to get it back set up over here and get tinkering with it some more, because I wanted to use it for that similar effect, because I do solo gigs, but they're, you know, solo cover gigs. You know, people want to hear classics, but I'm bored to tears with that, and I want to do something, throw occasionally, you know, something curveball-y in the middle of those kind of gigs. And so I'm hoping to use that to be able to do something just a little different, just a little oddball.
Yeah, the mood is super powerful. And I've worked out how to do things really quick on it. Like, you've got two presets, or you can buy a pedal to have more, but I don't have room for another pedal. So, I've worked out how to do, like, you know, octave harmony sort of things with it and all sorts of stuff quickly. But the ability to just have that really quick, you know, pad loop thing in the background, and just to not distract from the performance or overtake. Right. That's what I love about it, because it just means I can just create that thing really quickly and people don't even know. It just happens. It's just, and people may not even tell, but it's really cool just to have that ability without spending, even 1 or 2 minutes setting up some sort of extensive loop.
Yeah. No, that's super rad. I love it. And so I'm going to go back and I'm going to hunt that track down specifically, because, like I said, I may have actually listened to it, but I don't know track names.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So you said Unify was your last album you recorded. You've already released a track off a new album. So let's talk about that new album. When's that coming out?
I'm going to say early next year. I finished mixing it yesterday.
Oh, nice.
As we speak. So, and it was sort of this crazy lockdown sort of project again, in that, Australia, we went back in and out of lockdowns quite a bit the last few years. And it was sort of the end of last year we went into another one again. And so I got on the phone with my band in LA, and they could actually be in a room together. So we recorded drums and bass, them live. I sent them guide tracks and we sort of did it online. And then just through the realities of, I don't know, so many things going on, getting back to touring, playing, holiday seasons, mountain bike crashes, which keep happening to me. That's another story. It's taken me a while to sort of get it finished. And it was also just sort of, this next album is very songy and very singer-songwriter almost, but instrumental still. And so, like, even with the song Aging, you'll hear, like, it's, you know, I actually haven't worked out how to play it live yet, because it really needs at least two guitar parts, if not, I don't know, five. And then I even do like sing backing vocals to the guitar at the end of the song as well. So there's all, like, it's, which are really like sort of Ben Folds influenced, early Ben Folds Five albums and things. And so the whole album, it was sort of this balance of going, I sort of want to get more into releasing some of this more jazz trio stuff, but this album has come out really as like a, it's not pop, because I'm nowhere near what pop is currently is, but pop in the early 2000s.
There's not enough bossa nova keyboard beats on there.
Yeah. So, and, and lots of guitar parts. I kind of went a little bit crazy with, you know, all these extra little guitar bits that I sort of hear in my head that maybe don't even need to be there, but I just wanted to put them on. So
it makes it's you been happy. This, that's what works.
Yeah. So it's been this really sort of fun, process, and it's just got all these like influences of, you know, like I said, like Ben Folds and Fiona Apple and, definitely John Mayer and, all the, and then even through to like the, there's one song that was really heavily inspired by the whole Pino Palladino Blake Mills album that came out.
Yeah.
Notes with Attachments and
yes.
And then elements of Floritone, which was this band with Bill Frisell and Matt Chamberlain. And you know, it was basically like we didn't have a lot of time to record this, the drums and bass, and it was like at the end I'm like, oh, can you guys just play this and now just play in this key and now just play in this key, and then I, you know, edited it together and created sort of this song out of it. And
oh, that's super cool.
Yeah. And so it'll be a really interesting album because it has no point. I've already decided it's called Beyond Reason because there's not really a reason for it to, you know, like, especially getting older, you're all also going, why am I still doing this? What when you're not a rock star and, you know, questioning everything. But also like, yeah, it was just like, and then why wouldn't I do it? So
that's the bigger question.
Yeah. So it's really, predominantly, you know, sort of fun. And yeah, I hated it for a little while and now I really love it. Now it's finished. So
I like to hear other guitar players say, no, I hated everything I recorded. Now I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I definitely, yeah, actually, you know, one of the things was actually I had trouble recording in, we live in an apartment and it was like, there was, because of lockdowns and things, there wasn't a studio I could go to.
Right.
And so I was trying to record here, but it was the middle of our summer. So it was like 100 degrees and 100% humidity and we don't have air conditioning. And so I'd go to play, I'd just rot my guitar and rot my strings and then just be over it. So I was done. Well, I'm sweating now. You can see that. So it's, I don't know.
Oh my gosh,
today.
Dude.
Yeah. Yeah. Australian housing is basically sheds at the most part.
Oh my gosh, that sounds horrific. As someone who lives in one of those 100 degree, 100 humidity kind of places, I could not imagine doing it without AC.
Yeah, yeah, we just don't play music at home in summer. Yeah, it's,
Oh my gosh.
But I live very close to the beach as a bonus.
Well, there you go. There's at least that. Yeah. And mountains, apparently, for mountain biking. But
yes.
Or hills, at least.
Yeah, there are hills. Yeah.
Well, Adam, this has been great. We're getting real close to the end of the episode. We're going to wrap up and head over to the Patreon episode. Mm. So listeners, make sure you click all the links below. I've got all of the ways you can find Adam and his music on Instagram and Spotify and website. And if I can find other links, I'll try to find links to his like childhood school photograph albums and, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
When I start hunting for Google links, everything's fair game if it's on Google. So,
well, the thing is still, there are a lot of Adam Millers and there are other musicians and instrumental guitar players named Adam Miller. So it's also easy to get down a rabbit hole of not me.
Yeah, it is. This is him trying to say, if you find something embarrassing, it's not me.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. But yeah, appreciate it. So a couple of
things. Thank you so much.
Listeners, I do have some listeners down in Australia. Thank y'all for listening and hanging out. When this episode goes live, you will have already played Factory Theater with Matt Schofield.
Is that correct? Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. But you'll have... Lizotes in Lambton.
Lizotes. Yeah. Lizotes. Yeah. And that's actually in Newcastle. That's in my hometown. So
awesome.
That'll be a fun show.
So you Australian listeners, if you listen to this when it goes live tonight, go check that out at Lizotes. Mm. In the meantime, let me thank all of my patron supporters. I greatly appreciate your support. You are all you know, I hear that supporting this podcast makes you better looking, and you are all evidence of that, and thank you so much. At the $10 high wattage level, got Ben Fair, Dan Pilver from Lewitt Microphones, Heath Batt, thank you so much. At the $5 medium wattage level, we've got Andy Koning, Giacomo Ride, Jeffrey Walks, Jim Burns, Kyle Harris, Rick Calhoun from Honey Picks, Scott Hamilton from the Effects Loop podcast, and Tom Kelly. Thank you all for your support. Again, you keep this show on the road. In the meantime, y'all remember to be good to yourselves, be kind to each other, and make some noise. This episode is brought to you by the supporters of 40 Watt Podcast over on Patreon. Go over to patreon.com/40wattpodcast, where for as little as $3 per month, you can help support the podcast and get every episode ad-free. For $5 a month, you'll get every episode ad-free, as well as a bonus episode every week. I can't overstate how thankful I am for the support of my patrons, and hope you'll consider joining the team and helping keep this show on the road.